Keith worked on. Hello, Sean. Okay. So, today what I'm going to do is give you a very general picture. I'm going to start by giving you a general picture of how Kant conceives of how the mind functions to produce all of our representations. So this is, like Locke and like Hume, a model of mind which is supposed to account for all mental content. That means everything of which you can be consciously aware and anything that contributes to the content or structure of any concepts you have. Okay? So literally, all your ideas and all possible propositions, at least in principle, the origins of the content of those propositions and ideas is going to be accounted for with this model. Okay? And if you understand, and by the time we get through, I get through explaining the basics, I think I'll be in a position to explain to you how Kant thinks that he can solve that problem that it was on the quiz on number two. How he's going to recover objective knowledge and defeat Hume's skeptical challenges to the claim that I know there's an external world and that mostly how I perceive it corresponds to how it actually is. Okay, which both of which were challenged by Hume. Okay, so the first thing that you need to know, and this just is a consequence of that insight that we talked about 2 days ago when I introduced Kant to you, that Kant thought that all of the empiricists and all of the irrationalists made the same mistake. Each of them thought they had to derive all objective knowledge strictly and solely from one of the two obvious faculties of the human mind. The empiricists thought they had to get all objective knowledge of the world from sense perception, and the rationalists thought that all objective knowledge of the world had to ultimately be derived from reason. Each of these faculties was, by each of those traditions, regarded as the sole faculty that can be used that is available to us to establish objective truths about the external world. Kant said each of them was wrong in that respect. Kant says it takes two faculties. And his model of mind shows us, reflects that idea. So he broadly thinks that experience consists of intuitions brought under concepts. If you combine intuitions and concepts, the result is cognition, which is interpreted perception. Which is what you, in your everyday life, refer to as your experience, right? You have your perceptions, and you actually are capable of grasping the meaning, the significance, of the objects of perception, right? You don't see raw data. You see organized data, don't you? You don't see a strange, shambling, furry creature with four feet. You see a dog. It's on four hoofs. It's a horse, or it's a camel, or it's a sheep, etc., okay? And each of those you are easily able to recognize by the time you're 3 or 4 years old. The part that sense perception provides by itself is actually hard to recover unless you take your ordinary experience in which you are applying conceptual categories to your perceptions and then get rid of the part that involves recognition of which objects of perception correspond to your categories and try to decompose what's left into its parts. And if you do that, you end up with a picture not unlike the picture that we got from Locke and Hume, where you have my perception of the table is actually a construction drawn from a whole bunch of distinct viewings and touchings, right, of the table from different angles, which I compile together to produce the idea of the table, right? So the contribution of sense perception ultimately depends on sensations and consciousness that are being combined by some means into the idea of an object. And so you might say that the raw inputs of sense perception are not themselves organized. They have to get organized somehow. And a good deal of that organization is conceptual in nature. So Kant says that there are two kinds of representations of which the human mind is capable. And each of those kinds of representations is radically different from the other. One kind of representation is called, he calls an intuition. Or the other kind he calls a concept. Let's start with intuitions and talk about what is an intuitive representation. What Kant means by intuition is not what you might mean by using that word, right? In vernacular English, we usually mean something closer to... sometimes when we say, I have an intuition, what we mean is I have a guess. Or I have an inclination to think something, and I don't know how I have it. And I say it's an intuition because I'm trying to report to you that I have a seeming before my mind, right? But I'm not sure what it means, right? So I have an intuition that I'm gonna ace the final. You know, that way of talking. Some people use the word intuition in vernacular English these days to refer to some kind of pretty high-powered cognitive ability which is brought into play, for example, when you're doing math. Right? Where it's a name for the abstract reasoning you do in order, you know, for the individual abstract result, the results of abstract reasoning, right? So when I say, how do you know that the proof is valid, you will tell me that, well, the conclusion follows the premises, and if I press you, you will ultimately appeal to some kind of seeming, some kind of intellectual seeming, right? Which you might refer to as an intuition. It's a logical intuition. Can't you see it? And my name for that is a logical intuition. When you see the logical dependency of a conclusion on the premises in a valid argument, you are seeing something, right? And what you're seeing, you could refer to that as a logical intuition, if you like. That's something a lot of people have done. Leave all that aside. Intuitions for Kant are best thought of as sense perceptions. They are the kind of representation that you normally refer to as visual representations, tactile representations, auditory representations, right? Smells, tastes. Each of these is an example of an intuitive representation, according to Kant. And they all have something in common. When you notice your visual intuition right now, I want you all to concentrate on what you're seeing right now. That thing that you're seeing, all of it, that whole wad, is a visual intuition. And Kant thinks that it has something very much in common with an auditory intuition. I want you all to think now and notice what you're hearing. Buzz, voices, right? A whole bunch of sounds, and you're getting them all at once, right? It's like a...
aggregate?
Like what?
An aggregate?
It is. It's like an aggregate, isn't it? We talk in when we talk about vision, we talk about our visual field, right? And it's everything in that field that we mean when we talk about visual intuition. There's a combination or aggregation of various visual sensations, all presented to consciousness at once, right? At any given moment, you have a visual field. And at any given moment, you also have, although you probably never referred to it in this odd way, you have an auditory field, right? And you have a tactile field, don't you? I want you to concentrate on what your skin is reporting to you right now. Feel it. Feel the outside of your body, the pressure in your butt, just behind your knees, right? The air moving across your, you know, through over your head, right? Can you feel it? All of those together are a tactile field. Okay? Now, Kant thinks is distinctive about intuitions is that they are that kind of representation consisting in sensation that's all brought together and presented to consciousness at once. So if you take moments of auditory perception, moments of visual perception, moments of tactile perception, each of those is what Kant means by a visual intuition, tactile intuition, auditory intuition. It consists of a bunch of sensations organized together at once in a single representation brought before consciousness. So, intuitions have a structure. The structure of intuitions... Okay, I'm gonna just put this over here. The structure of an intuition... is what he calls a many-in-one structure. Many visual sensations brought together at once. Many auditory sensations brought together and presented to consciousness at once. Yeah.
Is it the sound and the sight put together, or is it only individually from one sense?
Both. But I'm glad you went there because, in fact, that's where I was going to go next. But I wanted each of you focus on visual fields first so you can see the many-in-one structure of what you're seeing right now. But now we can add the fact that at any one moment, we're aware of all of our sensations. They all, you might say that if you just stop thinking and just attend to everything in your sensorium right now, you have a whole bunch of things going on, right? And you can't really focus on all of them, but you can get a sense of the aggregate, right? There's a kind of an overall average or somehow that you're aware of it to some degree, right? And that, too, is an intuition. Now, it may not end up being an intuition that I can have an idea of, because maybe the aggregation of all my sensations from all my senses is too much for me to focus on and, you know, and store in memory, right? You probably would end up only storing some parts of it. And we do find it much easier to focus on particular aggregates of sensation if we restrict ourselves to vision for this shot, and then auditory for this shot, because it's much easier to take snapshots of each of the different sense modalities, because we seem to have a built-in power. It's a part of our capacity of sense perception, that we somehow are able to concentrate our attention on all the sensations coming in one sense modality better than we can multiple sense modalities. It starts to get complicated when we start trying to remember both what we saw and what we heard simultaneously, right? It just seems to be a feature of the way human concentration in perception works. Much easier to focus on the details of what you're seeing if you screen the rest out. So it's partly just that it's easier always to focus on something less that has less data. But I think there's something more than just the fact that there's less data. Because in fact, we find it very easy to focus on visual information, even though it's very clear if you just look at the content of the sensations and how they're arrayed in space. There's just no question the detailed information we get through vision is vastly greater than the detail we get through tactile or through auditory perception. So it just seems we have a very fine-grained visual faculty. Eagles have an even more fine-grained one, although maybe what eagles are good at means that they're not very good at kind of getting the whole picture the way maybe we are. Eagles are very good at seeing far away one little thing moving, which is kind of necessary because they have to swoop in from way up high and attack little tiny rodents. I mean, when there isn't something bigger to go after. And so they need to be able to see little tiny things at a great distance. But they may not be able to appreciate, you know, Guernica the way you can, because they may not be able to compile larger swaths of what they see and concentrate on the whole combination the way we do. So maybe we're better in that way of vision. Yeah.
I have a question to clarify.
Uh-huh.
So an intuition is the field of your sensations, and it's also the idea of that aggregate?
No.
No. It's not the idea.
No. We haven't gotten to... Right now, we're just working with we're working with how we get intuitions. And in fact, intuitions are ultimately going to be used as ideas. But when they get to the stage of being an idea, often they have already been somehow brought into relation with, you know, through the faculty of judgment with concepts. So we need to be very careful about this. This is a raw input, and insofar as a visual field at this moment, that snapshot, right, is recorded in your mind, it is what Hume called an idea. And intuitions are actual representations. Kant does not use this language because Kant realized that it was deeply confusing the way philosophers went back and forth between general representations, concepts, and particular representations, intuitions. And he thinks his new lingo is much better. So he's just going to say, I have intuitions. I have them right now. I'm immediately aware of them. But I also have the others that I've stored. And I don't refer to those as being different. One is a remembered intuition, right? And the other is an occurrent intuition. They're all the same.
What was current?
Occurrent. Like what I'm conscious of right now that I'm hearing,
yeah.
At least what I'm focused on right now, comprises an intuition of sound, sonic intuition, auditory intuition. And I might remember what I heard. And what I'm remembering when I do that is an intuition. Hume made this distinction between copies of impressions and impressions. Kant isn't going to do that. He's going to actually give us a richer theory. And he doesn't think that that part of Hume is very useful. It doesn't make much difference. You store what you saw in memory. And since it's a copy, why introduce the idea that it's a copy? Why not just say that it got stored? And your memory is better or worse at its job, which is to recover what you once stored.
Yeah. How does he account for our ability to focus on individual?
He doesn't. And in fact, nobody else has yet either. Cognitive science today might be managing to think about that, but he doesn't need that for the purposes of his work. That's a very subtle feature of consciousness. He's got other, much more basic things to account for before he needs to get to that. Okay, so at the moment, I'll actually give you a way of understanding how he accounts for it, but we have to understand how concepts are formed first. But it's actually just going to be a basic fact of our minds that we are able to focus our attention. And that's all he needs. And no one disputes that we're able to do that. And the best way to account for it is to say it's a feature of awareness. You know, it's a separable feature. It's different from being capable of having sensations, right? Having inputs, having sensations given to consciousness. It's different than being able to judge and so on. It seems to be another very general cognitive, capability. And since all of the human minds he's trying to account for have it, and that ability to focus our attention doesn't actually solve any philosophical problems that Kant is trying to solve, he doesn't talk about it. Okay. So, intuitions are representations having a many-in-one structure. They are a whole bunch of things brought together at once. And they're stored in memory sometimes, and sometimes they're just presented, you know, to current awareness. And what distinguishes them is that they are presented at once, all of their parts are presented at once, and they only function to represent themselves. They are representations that only represent themselves. They don't represent some other idea. That's what's distinctive about concepts. Concepts are the other radically different kind of representation of which human minds are capable. What's a concept? Well, it's just what Locke thought, insofar as Locke was thinking of what he called general ideas. It's something which stands for other representations in the way that a category, right, or the idea of a class is the idea of a group of things which have something in common. The concept is whatever, our concept of what they have in common is what helps us to define the class. So a concept is a representation which has, parallels, structure of concepts is the exact opposite. It is a one over many, or one to many kind of representation. Its structure is identified with the way that it points to diverse other representations. Okay? So the function of a concept is to group other representations under itself, right? In the way that we do when we are predicating an intuition of when we predicate a concept of, like the concept of radical ball, right? We're bringing the idea, the representation, the complex representation of ball under, right, the concept of red, right? So that's an act of what Kant calls subsumption. Subsumption, okay? Subsumption. Subsumption is what you do when you think of one thing as being an instance of something else, right? Like, there's another ironic fact about my life. There you are subsuming that fact about your life under the idea of, under the notion of irony, right? This day was a disaster. There you are subsuming the idea of the day under the idea of disaster. Okay? So that's what subsumption is, yeah.
Sorry, I missed part of the definition. It's what you think, what you do when you think of one thing.
A concept. I don't want to overcomplicate this. This is very simple. You guys all know what concepts are. Concepts are representations which stand in relation to other representations the way that the definition of a class stands to the members of the class, or the way that a predicate stands to the things of which it is predicated. Right? All red things are captured in the concept of red, correct? When I identify each of the red things in the world, what I'm doing is bringing each of those things under the concept of red. That's subsumption. And that is how concepts function. They're ways of, they're symbols for other representations, but not in the way that a name is a symbol, but the way that a category is a symbol. So the idea of a human being is a concept, right? Because it's an idea which doesn't just point to one human being. It points to anything that is a human being. What are some examples of other concepts?
Warm.
Anything that's warm. The concept of warm.
Concept of cold.
Is the idea of anything that happens to feel a certain way, you know, to the touch, right?
Your concept of wood.
And there's also a non-sensory way of concept of warm too, right? I mean, when the weatherman says it's warm out, they're actually giving you a report about the the average mean, you know, temperature of the air in a particular region, right? And that's objective. That's not a feeling of warmth. That is a measure of something out in the world. But either one of those is a concept, right? And anything that happens to be 72 degrees is going to fall under the concept of 72 degrees, right?
What about, like, our emotions and stuff, like love or anger?
Well, love is a feeling.
Right.
But there's a concept of love, too, right? So we have intuitions of love. When you feel love for someone, you're not having a concept. When you feel love, you're having a self-affection. You're having an intuition of emotion. Okay? And all of those parts of that emotion are presented to you at once. It has that many in one structure of all intuitions. So, but we have a concept of love, right? And that is not an emotion. It's the idea of an emotion, right? It's a symbol for all those felt all those instances in which somebody felt certain complex emotion, affection, and it's a very complicated emotion. Differing people give differing views of what exactly love consists in. Some people say love have a concept of love which ignores how people are feeling and looks only to what they're doing, right? Because often these are connected to relationships that one has with people that you love. And some people think that what matters in such relationships is what you do with each other, not how you felt when you formed the love in the first place. So they will look to the behavior. You know, that's the Oprah moment, right? You love him, but you beat him all the time. What kind of love is that? You know, or it's usually he. It's like.
What about concept of movement in relation to other things?
Okay. Well, so long as we're thinking of movement wherever it occurs, you'd have to be a little more precise. But maybe you mean it fully in the most general sense. All motion. We'd have to make it more precise because motion is always relevant motion, right? But as long as we define that much, all, you know, anything that is moving in relation to something else falls under that concept. So that certainly can be a concept. But what if I just talk about the motion of this cap? Now I'm not talking about a representation that is a concept, am I? I'm talking about my intuition of the motion of this cap. It doesn't represent anything but itself, so it's not a concept. Okay? It's an intuition of motion. And if I see enough motions, I might be able to form the idea of a concept of motion, which would apply to all of them, and then to anything else that resembles them, right? John and then Nora.
How about time?
Well, time, okay, let's, time, unfortunately you haven't said enough yet. Do you mean what time it is right now? Because that time is not a concept. When you say what time is it, Jason, I say it's 20 minutes of 2, that's not a concept. That's a particular time. Okay? However, there is a concept of time. There's even a concept of, you know, the hours of the day, right? That's we have a system of, you know, of clocks, right? Based on the roughly on the circuit of the Earth around the Sun, and we divide it up into days based on the rotation of the Earth, and these astronomical facts about the Earth and the solar system have led us to produce concepts of intervals of time, like hour, day, year, and those are definitely concepts, because if you ask me how much time is left today, you're asking me to tell you how many minutes are left, but I have to use the concept of a minute to do that. Right? Yeah, Nora?
So how do you have intuitions without concepts?
You can't.
Right. So I say...
Well, you can, but if you have them, intuitions without concepts are blind. So here's how Kant thinks it works. If you were to be a human mind, if your mind were just like yours, except that you'd never had any concepts, you only had intuitions, you would be an oyster. You would have the experience of an oyster. Your experience would only be of intuitions. You would not be able to recognize any of the intuitions you're having. So you wouldn't be able to think about them. You would just have them.
So you say, like, this shirt is blue, and that's an intuition, but you have to understand the concept of blue to be able to say that.
Exactly. Just like a little kid. Imagine someone who's still learning the concepts that we have, right? And let's say they're at the age where they're just starting to work out colors. This isn't to say that they don't detect the difference in the way blue looks and the way that black looks and the way that green looks, right? And the various shades. Because there's good evidence that even before babies know what the names of things, they can distinguish different colors. However, until they have the concept, they aren't in a position to sort things according to color. So if you had no capacity for concepts, you might have a capacity for discrimination, but you wouldn't be able to use it because you wouldn't be able to reflect about what it is that you were experiencing. So Kant makes a very important difference between what I'm literally seeing when I look at Colin's black shirt, how it looks to me in respect to the hue, and my act of recognition, which is required for me to notice that, oh, and recognize that as a black t-shirt, a black shirt, short sleeve summer shirt, probably cotton, nice shirt, polyester. Well, actually, they say that's even better for summer.
So, but you can't have a concept without memory. Is that basically what it's saying?
Well, he hasn't told us how we come to develop concepts from experience. I haven't told you that story yet. Right now, I'm just telling you that he thinks there are two kinds of representations, and both are required for us to have the kind of experience that I just had in looking at his shirt and noticing that it's black. Both things are needed, and we need to learn. His story about how we develop empirical concepts like the concept of black is going to be very much like Locke's. We're going to abstract from it particular intuitions of black-looking things, right? Patches of black. But Kant now can tell us how it is that we perform the magic of turning the black-looking thing we saw into a concept, which Locke never explained. We just have this magical power to treat what we're seeing in common among diverse simple ideas of sensation, intuitions of sensation, right? Sensible intuitions, as Kant calls them, sensible affections. We have this power to pluck what we're noticing they have in common and then use it in this brand new way as a word that points to anything that resembles them. Well, that is a move to concepts. That is a conceptual capacity, and Locke never accounts for it. Kant thinks he failed to recognize that something radically new is introduced into human, into mental content when you're able to use a patch of black, right, to represent anything that looks like that. That's something that the patch of black doesn't have and couldn't give it itself. So the mind is doing something it's never been able, that up until then, by simple perception, it's incapable of. And Kant is accounting for how this is possible, how I can take something I've seen and say, and then later say, I've seen this before, this is like something before, and then furthermore, I think there's something general going on here. This is the stage at which you start to think of what you originally experienced only as an intuition in general terms. Your ability to do that depends on the faculty of concepts. It's actually a power of judgment. And without it, you couldn't learn from experience. even if you had an oyster that had rich in, sensory inputs as great as ours, the poor thing, and even if you gave it memory, you know, go ahead, store as much as you like. It wouldn't be able to organize it. So it would just have like a really big hard drive with all kinds of junk on it. I mean, from its point of view, it would be just junk. Even if you gave it retrieval power, what would it do? How would it know what to retrieve? It'd be blind. It'd be like a random number generator, except applied to the content of what everything it had ever seen, heard, tasted, and felt. So, yeah, Nora.
Is that saying that we have the innate idea of a concept?
We don't have an innate idea, but we do have an innate power to produce concepts once we have inputs. So we have an innate capacity to produce concepts. And in fact, it's going to turn out that there are some structures that all concepts must have, or at least there turns out there are 12 different kinds of relations which you can capture in a concept. And those are determined by facts about the faculty of judgment or faculty of concepts. And that comes much later, but basically those structures are more innate. And so it's going to turn out that there are, because it turns out that the form of concepts is really best understood as the form, different ways that you can relate to different representations through a judgment. And I'm going to have to explain that later. But all concepts depend on your ability to bring one idea into a representation, into a relationship to another through judgment. To subsume one under another is to basically, remember I put that basic structure of all beliefs or all propositions in the form of SSP, subject concept, copula, predicate concept? Well, or the subject concept can be a particular representation like a patch of black, right? And the predicate could be another representation, a patch of green. And in that case, when I bring those into relation, I might think, that isn't that. That would be a judgment. I'm bringing two representations that are intuitions into relationship to each other, right? And when I do that, that's what I'm doing when I form a judgment. And it turns out that our ability to produce concepts from intuitions depends on our ability to bring one representation into a relation to another by thinking of one as an instance of the other. And I just gave you an example. Well, that's not an instance of the other. And when I say that patch of black is not like that patch of white, I'm now thinking of that, of both of them, as if they stood for something else or could, for some concept. Concept of black and the concept of white, and I'm saying that's not an example of one of, as that is, that's not an example of the kind of thing that is an example of. So there's a hidden third representation, which is, or third or fourth, the concept of black, the concept of white, and I'm noticing something about intuitions of white and black, given that I'm thinking about both of them in terms of whether they could stand for each other. Whether they could be concepts that point to each other. And they can't. So they're concepts that announce that nothing that's in one will be in the other class. Nora with an H?
I'm not sure. I don't understand how this is objective, though, because these sound like really relative things.
Well, so far I'm only telling you how mental content is constructed. The objectivity is going to come when I give you the rules for the formation of intuitions and the rules for the formation of concepts. And those rules, it turns out, are going to produce something objective even among our perceptions. But I haven't gotten to that yet, Nora. So you're absolutely right. So far, I'm only talking about how representations are understood on Kant's model of mind. And we haven't actually stepped outside the mind yet to try to figure out what we can know about the world. So we're not there. We're not even close to doing that yet. John?
How many experiences does it take to form a concept? Just two? Just like essence of black?
There is no general rule. As many as it takes your mind to get it done. That's not a question that he needs to answer. That has to do with, you might say, cognitive development. He's giving us a general theory of how all representations arise, and he's not working out the details of how it works for each individual mind because he doesn't have to. If he can show that there's something in the mind's way of producing representations that creates something universal and necessary in all perception, then he will have accomplished the first step in showing that synthetic a priori judgments are possible by showing that there's something a priori in perception. And thus that Hume was wrong to think, and everybody else before him was wrong to think, that all sense perceptions are contingent and solely contingent sources of information. Yeah.
I guess from what we were talking about with judgment, mm-hmm. the comparing two things and deciding what they're not, if you experience, say, a new color, mm-hmm. you could then, therefore, develop a concept of that new color based on only one instance of that color in relation to what it isn't.
Yeah. I mean, in theory, given that the power to produce concepts is a power that you have when you're born, your mind, you know, as soon as you have a mind, according to Kant, you have this power. You could form a concept. Once you got used to how judgment works, you would need some experience making judgments. But once you start having judgments, then you could produce a concept from a single experience. Just as, and very much the same way that Hume said, remember the quiz, that you could produce the idea that the thing that just preceded this effect that you just observed was the cause of it, even if you've only seen those two events once. Because you have the general idea that wherever you see anything, there's something that preceded it in time and is contiguous in space, right, which is its cause, and you just go looking for it automatically. So you might say that it's the practical form of the principle of sufficient reason, which or human minds develop as a principle in practical life ordinarily without being philosophers. We just start looking for the causes of things. Because our experience tells us that everything that happens has some cause once you've had enough experience. Okay? All right. So, I'm going to bracket the talk about concepts. I just want you to know. I'm going to come back to concepts. But for now, we're only going to consider the contribution that intuitions make to experience. Okay? Because that is the story of that. Of the contribution of intuitions to cognition is the burden of the transcendental aesthetic, and this is what Kant is entirely focused on there. So we are only concerned with how intuitions arise, what they consist in, and how they come into existence. And on that score, Kant thinks that intuitions, these many in one representations, when you look closely at them, you realize that each intuition, each manifold of sensation, because he thinks that the mind is empty until you start having sensations, and these sensations come in aggregates, to use Casey's word. Kant's word for this is manifolds. We have a manifold of sensations. As soon as we start having sensations, they're being grouped together in manifolds. And the combination is an intuition. These intuitions have two components. One which he refers to as the matter of the perception, which corresponds to just the sensation. In the case of sense perceptions, it's just the sensation. And then the form, and the form is the order of the sensations, the ordering of the sensations. All sense perceptions consist of sensation plus something else. And the transcendental aesthetic is the place where Kant argues, I think pretty persuasively, that all our sense perceptions are a combination of sensation and a way of putting them in an order the order of time and the order and spatial order. And these two orders in the Transcendental Aesthetic, he tries to argue, are things that are given to sensations by something in the mind acting on what is given to it. And the burden of the Transcendental Aesthetic is to prove that space and time are the form of outer intuition. Intuitions come in two forms. Outer, those are sense perceptions. And inner, and the group of inner intuitions includes every outer sense perception has an inner aspect and an outer aspect, but there are some affections, some intuitions, which only are inner. My awareness of my emotions, my awareness of my acts, my mental operations, so my intuitions of my memory, my intuition that I'm remembering right now, my intuition that I'm noticing that I'm remembering right now, my intuition that I'm seeing something right now and noticing that I'm seeing. These are all examples of inner affections, self-affections, the way the mind affects consciousness and reveals to consciousness that the mind is engaged in an activity of its own. Okay? So, all sense perceptions initially are outer affections, outer intuitions. They're given to us, and they all come with a spatial and temporal order. And when you think about it, that's true. Think about each of the different sensory modalities and ask yourself, are any of those presented non-spatially? No. All of them. The smells? Right? Where do you smell the meal? Right here, don't you? Roughly in here somewhere. Isn't that where you smell it? Where you taste? You taste it right here, don't you?
On you, but you smell it down the street.
Well, don't confuse the cause of what you're smelling. I'm not saying that what I'm smelling is all created in my nose. I am saying that my awareness of what I'm smelling is located in this space. And actually, as a sophisticated further fact about it, I can walk around while I'm smelling it and figure out that the origin of it is down the block in that incredible, Middle Eastern bakery that I need to get to right now. Right? Sam, did you? No? Nora?
It's time the same way. It's like something's being cooked, so you smell it, or it takes this long to smell it, or is it...
Time is another formal feature of sense perception. So it's true also that all of my sense perceptions do come in time. They come in an order, right? And the evidence for that is obvious, right? I experience what I just said as falling before what I'm saying now. I experience that as a temporal order. Just by thinking about what I just said, I can notice the way that what I'm saying now is coming later. It's a part of my sense perceptions that they have this temporal structure, right? I also can tell when something I'm hearing is simultaneous with my voice, right? So there is that temporal aspect too. But unlike the spatial order, not all intuitions... Sense perceptions all have to be presented in space, and they're the only intuitions that are. So my intuitions of emotion and my intuitions of my inner workings, my mental activities, the stream of my consciousness, taken as a stream of my consciousness, all of those are inner affections that only have the form of time. None of them are presented to my consciousness in space. But all of my intuitions are presented to me in time, including the ones that don't come from my senses, but come from my those other sources of intuitions. My emotions, my reflections, my memory, my remembering, all those mental activities, the act of will by which I say, yes, Clay, there's an act of will in there, among other things, and I noticed it just as I did it. That is a self-affection. That is an intuition of willing, of an act of will. And I know I have acts of will. How? Because my act of will presents, affects my consciousness and produces an intuition of which I'm aware. How it would be. So Clay,
When you talk about inner intuitions in relation to time, is it just in ordering that you're thinking of things before or after one another?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we develop the sense of time as far as inner intuitions go?
Mm-hmm. Right. Say that again. I was a little distracted. I'm not sure I heard it all. Say it again.
Well, we develop, say, essentially perceptions of intuitions. We can form them spatially, obviously, because it seems more obvious that they're apart in space.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking about inner intuitions in relation to time, is it simply the fact that one thought of, say, like self-reflection precedes another?
Yeah. I mean, that's what he means by saying that all inner affections have the form of time. They all have temporal relations to the other, to others, to any others. Now you may not notice or even care about the fact that the awareness of your stream of consciousness right now, what's being presented to you right now in consciousness, which may, let's say it's a self-affection. You're noticing that you're thinking right now. That's a self-affection. That's an inner intuition, which has no spatial mode of presentation because it's not a sense of perception. And you may not even notice that it's long after one that you had when you were in fifth grade. So it isn't like we are conscious of all of the intuitions that we've ever had and their spatial and or temporal relations to each other. It's just that as we experience them phenomenologically, as the stream of consciousness unfolds, all intuitions have the form of time. Make sense? And I want you to realize that when I say the form of time, it's going to be hard for you because all of you think of time as being an objective feature of the world. But I want you to think of time only in terms of the subjective experience of time that you think you're having. Right? And when I ask you to talk about your subjective experience of time, what comes to mind, Eric? What do you suppose it is you are directly aware of that corresponds to time?
I don't answer your question.
Well, I'm asking you what you think time is, and if you think time is something you're directly aware of, and if it is, what is it? What is it that you're aware of? Does anybody here think that time is something you're aware of? Luke? This will play out here. Now, let me ask Luke, since you think that it's something you're aware of, what exactly is it that you're aware of? Tell us about it. Report to us.
You're aware of changes in things that you, in your mind, have ascribed that they change over time. Like the beating of a butterfly's wings, you know that it's not happening instantaneously, and you watch it happening, so you know that time is passing, and you can relate to it.
Okay. So what you are calling time passing is actually the temporal order of things that you're aware of.
There's no.
Now let me ask you this is going to be useful and it's something I would have done anyway, so I'm going to tease something out here. I want you to, so you can notice the temporal relations between things you're conscious of.
Yeah.
And that's good. Now I want you to imagine that the things you are conscious of are being removed one by one. The fluttering of the butterfly's wings, all the sensations associated with the fluttering, visually, maybe you've got it in your hand, and you're feeling its little wings beating, right? And you remove all those sensations. What's left over?
And you're obviously not just the butterfly, but everything.
Yeah, like everything you were conscious of. We'll start with the butterfly, then noticing your hand, then just removing the sensations. As we remove the sensations, you might have thought that what would be left over would be two things. A spatial container, empty of sensations, but something like, you know, like empty space. But space and time, the stream of time. But the puzzling thing is that when you remove everything else, there's nothing left over that you're conscious of.
So could you not have thoughts? Because if you have thoughts, you can still order the time that you have thoughts.
Well, you can have thoughts, and as long as you have thoughts, you haven't actually eliminated all the content of consciousness that, you know, I was talking about. But you no longer have anything coming in from outside. And so insofar as you think that time is a feature of the world of your perceptions, time has disappeared there. Right? Because what you're now conscious of when you're conscious of your thoughts, apparently, the thoughts you're having are apparently non-perceptual. They're not intuition or sensation. There are no more sensations, so you must just be conscious of your inner states. And that would still have a temporal ordering for us. I'm trying to get you to see that what you're perceiving outside would cease to have a temporal form, because there wouldn't be there'd be no temporality. Time is gone when you get rid of the sensations that are presented to you with the temporal relationship. Because you can't witness the relationship without having the relata, the things that are you're conscious of, like the beat of each beat of the wing. And similarly with your thoughts, John, imagine removing your thoughts and ask yourself whether time would be left over.
Well, with the thought thing,
it's just that at this point we're now talking about something that we don't have an organized way of thinking about. We haven't been trained in how to think about the causes of our inner experience. And the purpose here is to try to get us to learn something about perception. So Kant is not going to perform that thought experiment. Because, in fact, if you think away all your thinking, there's nothing left, including your ability to think about that. So that is a thought experiment that doesn't take us anywhere. But the thought experiment about removing all conscious sensations and asking yourself whether space or time are left, whether there's anything that you're conscious of after you remove all the conscious sensations, that is very useful because it reveals something to us that Kant is trying to show in the Transcendental Aesthetic. That space and time are not objects of perception, although everybody before Kant thought that they were real properties of the causes of our perceptions in the world outside. Everybody thought that space and time were real. You might say space was a real container that held the objects of perception and was left, you know, when you removed all the objects, right? I mean, people often talk this way. What if everybody was gone? It was like, you know, one of those movies where you go up Times Square, right, and there's nobody there. Well, now just take it further. No Times Square, no Earth, no solar system, get rid of all the stars, what do you have left? Well, often you think that space is the container for all those objects. But Kant has noticed that if it is a container, it's not perceived. And time is not perceived either. We perceive that things have temporal relations. But if we get rid of the things that are temporally related, there isn't something left over that we perceive, that we're conscious of. And this is one step in loosening your conviction that space and time are real properties of what's given to your mind and perception. And once he has you there, then he's in a position to try to give the arguments that he gives in the Transcendental Aesthetic that show that he has several arguments that try to show that space and time are given to what is are imposed on or created by something active in the faculty of intuition, the faculty of appearances. And it is given to sensations because this is a minimum requirement for us to be conscious of sensations. Okay. And the reason that we need them is that Kant's, well, what Kant is doing is saying, let's see whether the empiricists were right about space and time. If the concept of space and the concept of time were drawn from sense perception, then I ought to be able to find something in the literal content of my perceptual awareness that corresponds to them. And this thought experiment I just gave you is meant to reveal what was revealed about the concept of substance by Locke and what was revealed about the concept of necessary connection by Hume. That if you apply the empiricist criterion of intelligibility, the concept of space has nothing in perception corresponding to it. And since there's nothing in perception corresponding to it, it is nothing at all. It's an empty concept. And yet we think that we're thinking about something that we do take it to really exist. We think there are temporal relations. Now the question is, how do they get there? Since the relations seem to disappear with the relata. Obviously, space and time are something in perception, right? They're the part that involves the ordering of sensations in space and time. The thing that gives them spatial and temporal order, right? Time is needed for that. And when I have intuitions of sensation, they all do have spatial and temporal relations to others, right? Often simultaneously, like all of these sensations are arrayed in space and in time, because I can tell that those things are spinning, and for that I need to have, you know, I need to notice the motion, which requires me to locate that those things, those blades that I'm seeing up above me, I'm able to notice that they are moving in space, which means I'm also observing them in time. I'm observing temporal relations. Right, especially if I follow one of the particular blades. Okay. Yeah, Nora.
So then, what? I mean, don't you need space to understand distance, though?
You do need space in order to understand distance. The question is, how does distance get there? That's the question Kant is asking. How do we know that there is such a thing as distance between objects? Well, we know it on the basis of perception, right? We can make measurements based on perception.
Because we know there's space in between.
Well, we measure the space between, right? But when we're measuring the space between, are we measuring the space or are we measuring, or are we putting the tape measure, the beginning of the end of the tape measure where the first one is, and we're pulling the tape measure across to measure the relationship between them in space. What Kant is trying to get you to see is that when you measure the distance between two objects, you're not measuring space.
Right, we're not measuring space, but we still need the space.
You need we absolutely need the space in order for things to be kept apart.
So then how is that empty?
Well, it isn't empty when you're having perceptions as we do. Kant didn't say space is empty, therefore space is nothing. Kant said you perceive everything that you're conscious of as a sensation in your awareness. And you may think that the space, that the distance between two objects of visual perception, like Old Main and that tree, right, have space between them. But if you think that, imagine that what you're seeing is removed. And ask yourself if space is left over. And if space is not left over, then you need the sensations and something that comes with them in order to have space as a mode of relation among objects of perception. So the question Kant is trying to answer is, given that space isn't something I perceive, where does it come from?
Well,
He's not denying that there is space, Nora. He's wondering how we get there. How do we get that spatial relationship among our perceptions for those that are spatially related? And that's true of all our sense perceptions. How do they get spatial relations? If they're not given in perception, and they aren't, because if you imagine all the things that are given to your consciousness, all the sensations, there's nothing left over, then they must be something that, he says, well, then they must have been put there by the mind itself. There's no other way to account for it.
They were subsumed.
Oh, well, they are built into the perceptions, and the question is, how do they get there? We have subsumed them under a concept of real space, right? A fixed container in which the world exists. But we don't perceive that. So how do we get the idea of it? Kant's answer is, the mind must be responsible for generating this way of ordering sensations. And he thinks something else. He says, obviously, if the mind is giving sensations a spatial mode of presentation, way of being presented to consciousness, there must be some function that it's performing for me that's essential to perception. Otherwise, the mind wouldn't do it. It's a big burden for it to produce the spatial way of presenting sensations so that they can have an order in space. And so Kant asks himself, well, what is space doing for me? And what is time doing for me? This is a question no one had ever asked. And when he asks it, here's what his answer is. Just by asking, what does space do for me? Well, actually, he starts by saying, what does time do for me? Well, imagine that you have two, given that you don't know what kind of sensations you're going to have, imagine you're designing your perceptual faculty so that you'll be able to have perception as you actually do. Here's one thing you're going to need to be able to do. You're going to have some visual sensations that are identical to others. Right? How are you going to keep them apart? Imagine you walk into a room and it's all white. And as far as you can see from where you are, there's nothing distinguishable in it. You know, it's like some, you know, torture room where you step in and it's just, or let's make it some really disgusting color, right? Some kind of pukes, you know, some nauseating version of green, right? Sort of really pale avocado, all right? And everything is avocado. Avocado, it's that same hue everywhere. How are you going to keep it organized so that you can distinguish one avocado sensation, one patch of avocado from another? Well, what you need, minimally, is a way of separating them so that you can have them be qualitatively identical to consciousness and yet distinguishable. And the minimum condition for that is time. If you present them in time, then you'll be able to keep track of them. My example was confusing because I asked you to go into a room and that's in space. And of course, if you have space available to you, it gets even better. Now you can present two patches of, you know, two sensations of pale avocado in space, and that way you can keep them apart even at the same time. Right? So you can have qualitatively identical sensations and you can keep them apart. Let me motivate this again using a different example. How if you have a pain? Imagine you're having a pain, and you're having multiple sensations of an identical pain. The pain is exactly the same. Anybody here ever have migraine headaches? Long persisting migraine headaches? Okay, good. So you guys know what I'm talking about. When I talk about a pain that stays the same, horribly the same for hours, or at least for many moments, right? But all of you have had pain at one time or another, of some kind or another, where it was, you recently, John, where it was the same pain, right, over and over and over and over and over again. And that's what's horrible about it. You want it to ease up, right, and go away ideally. How is it possible for your mind to present pain that feels exactly, every sensation of the pain is exactly like every other sensation of that pain. What's the minimum condition for representing that so that you can keep them apart? Keep distinct sensations of pain apart. The minimum condition is time. If you present them in time, then they can be the same pain over and over and over and over again. But now consider this. Suppose you have that same pain, but you want to represent it. You want to represent two pains that are qualitatively identical, but you want to distinguish them, and you can't use time. Then how would you do it, Nora?
Well, can you still use space?
Yes, you
so
have it available to you.
So you have your migraine in class, and then you have your migraine out in the hallway?
Sure. Or maybe the migraine is tough because it's actually global, and so you really wouldn't. If you did it here and in the hallway, you would have had it at a different time, so you wouldn't have to bother with the whole hallway business,
okay.
Right? But imagine that you have two pains that you're going to have simultaneously. I mean, this is frightening, and as far as I know, it's impossible. Let's try to imagine two migraine headaches at once, which you can distinguish. How are you going to keep them apart?
One over your left eye and one over your right.
Bingo, exactly. Put them in space. So Kant thinks that these kinds of reflections reveal the real function of space and time, which is to provide us a way of keeping our sensations apart so that we can keep track of them, distinguish them one from the other, in the way that in fact we do. There are all kinds of things in the world of our perceptions, right? All our sensations, I always joke here about how at a certain age you realize you've experienced all of the sensations. There aren't going to be any new ones. Death. Well, there's that. If it's a sensation. You know, and I guess that keeps us interested. But there is a point at which you've kind of, you know, sometimes it's just a lack of adventurousness on your own part. And you need to get up, you know, and look around and, you know, break some of your habits. And that's a good strategy. But even if you're good at that, probably at some point, at least when it comes to the literal sensations of which you're possible, if you have any sort of passion, any kind of intensity and vigor, you know, at your age, you know, by the time you're 40 or 50, you're going to pretty much have experienced everything that's out there. Okay? Let's suppose, for the sake of this discussion, that that's true, because I don't really care if it is. I think you would all agree that there's a point where it really gets hard to get to the new experiences, at least. And let's just imagine, you know, it all dries up and you just don't get any more. Surely, that's the position the human mind is broadly in. We have a certain range of sensations, and in fact, lots of them are repeated. Yet we can keep them apart and think about them and see them as parts of our experience, even when they're the same. Our experience requires us to be able to notice the things that are repeated, right? Even if there's some hope that there'll be something new coming along soon, right? The fact of cognition as we have it, experience as we have it, does allow us to keep these perceptions and experiences, which are really identical, even complex ones, apart from each other. And space and time is the minimum condition for our being able to do that. That's the function of space and time. And it seems to be a requirement for minds like ours. And Kant thinks it's possible there could be minds which keep qualitatively identical sensations apart so that you can be conscious of their distinctness, conscious now of their distinctness, without using space and time. There might be something else, Space and Stein, for some special creature not like the human, right? The Spumen mind. And that mind has these other faculties, which other ways of presenting sensations, other forms. And if you had that kind of mind, you would know what I'm talking about. But you don't. You only have your kind of mind. And your mind keeps sensations distinguishable by using spatial and temporal modes of presentation. So space and time, while they are real properties of the world of your perceptions, because you couldn't have perceptions without them. The consciousness of sensation without these is impossible, because we couldn't keep track of it. Because if you imagine a consciousness that has sensations piling in on it without space and time as modes of presentation, what would it be like? Take all the sensations you ever had, even the ones that are different, the rich, diverse beauty of your snowflakey life. What's it going to come to? What would it be like to experience that? You've got to imagine what it would be like to experience all those sensations all at once. It would be chaos. It wouldn't be anything like our experience, would it? And Kant thinks that this is what would happen if our minds tried to be conscious of sensations without first taking what's given to the mind and altering it by giving it this way of being related. So basically the idea is that we have inputs to our minds which come from some place we know not what. We know nothing about it. Because by the time the sensations are conscious, they're now representations and they're no longer things outside the mind. And as soon as those inputs arise, come to the mind translates them into a spatial and temporal mode of presentation so that we can handle it. You might say it filters the data through these two, the spatial and temporal template, so that they can have an order which allows us to keep track of all of the parts of it without being confused, without being overwhelmed. Think of it as an evolutionary requirement of minds like ours that are finite and can't really absorb trillions of sensations all at once. Okay? Cool. You're buying it? Not yet. I haven't got a hold of you yet. I'm working.